This is the Counter Ruck Rugby Podcast, brought to you by the Irish Times in association with Nifty Business. My name is Nathan Johns. And on the Monday after Ireland have won back-to-back Six Nations crowns, we are here to talk through Ireland's victory over Scotland. I'm joined, as always, by Gordon Darcy and Gerry Thornley. Morning, lads.
Good morning.
Morning.
Darce, on Saturday when we were chatting, you kind of said nobody, their history books don't record the performance of how you won the title. They just record that you won the title. I think that's a fair enough way of summing up what was a tricky afternoon for Ireland, but nonetheless a very positive one.
Maybe we got carried away with how impressively Ireland started the tournament. And, you know, I suppose you have to, with the benefit of hindsight now, and you know, the enormity of the winning another championship is probably as sunk in. Maybe a little bit of pressure did play onto it, and teams were really focused and driven to try and upset Ireland. And you kind of feel there's probably a little bit of a consistency now, teams figuring out how to slow down Ireland. But they did enough to win, and I think that's a huge testament to them, to the players, the resolve, everything that was in that. It was far from a vintage performance. Scotland did almost everything right. But yeah, Ireland had earned the right for a second shot at the championship, and did just enough to get it. And yeah, like, because you were saying just before we started, you know, we did back to back in 2014 and 15. Probably not the vintage performances all the way through, but it's really tough. And they say, yeah, they've gone. I couldn't tell you in 14 or 15 how good or bad the performances were. Like, we, you know, just about got over the line against France in 2014, thanks to Dave Kearney, big defensive read on the touchline.
The forward pass.
Yes, like, but yeah. huge moments, and put that into the hopper. And yeah, these boys will be, they won't care about, you know, the what ifs and what could have been. They've got a championship trophy.
That's ultimately all that matters at the end of the day, Gerry, isn't it? We can talk about performances. We can talk about maybe they peaked in the opening night and probably didn't get to that high again throughout the tournament. We can talk about maybe the fact that England did figure them out. Scotland figured them out for 60 minutes or so in terms of holding out their attack. But that doesn't really matter right now.
No, I mean, back-to-back slams have never been done in Six Nations history, and there's a reason why. And this is only the third time that a Grand Slam winner has retained the title the following year. Because when you're top dog, everybody analyses you to death. You're the prize scalp in the tournament, and everybody came after Ireland. Okay, maybe we overrated the opening night, performed a little bit in Marseille. I think that contributed to the French hangover as well, though. I think it compounded the hangover. We didn't realise how much they were dependent on maybe on Antoine Dupont, and only really with Nolan Le Garrick back in the team that in the last two games they find a little bit of stardust and finish the tournament better than they started it. Whereas I think Ireland, they got a bit weary towards the end maybe. That's 13 internationals in what, since August. Like, that's a lot of internationals. And they started really well, and then they were targeted. And I think on Saturday there was a little bit of a post-Twickenham hangover maybe as well, both within the crowd and the team, that we had built this up into being a tilt at back-to-back slams. It wasn't the players, it wasn't the management. I don't think they mentioned the words back-to-back slam once. The perpetrators were me and you. And
it's all our fault, Gerry. We did
build up expectations, and the public's expectations were for back-to-back slams. So when that was denied them, I think it's perhaps a little bit inevitable that playing a 13th international, like on a human level, we've got to understand how much a World Cup takes out of these players. They're not robots.
I think that's a really good point, Gerry. And I think it was in certain positions we looked just a little bit heavy-legged or a little bit tired. And you kind of felt other teams were able to freshen. You look at the teams that finished.
Absolutely.
Really.
Nolan Le Garrick really refreshed, and so did Labar at full back. And
Chesham, yeah, coming in the back. Like, there, yeah, was players, yeah, energised. Yeah. Ollie Lawrence in with for England. Yeah. They just had, you know, we had, again, a very, very settled team. But you kind of think, you know, James Ryan was definitely missed in the last two matches. And, you know, possibly a little bit of freshness in the back row. And, you know, Jemison Gibson-Park, full of endeavour. Like, brilliant, again. But you just look at it and go, you know, did he look a little bit tired in the last 2 weeks?
I think they deserve a few days off now. They're going to enjoy them. And I think I hope they get a week off, really. But whenever they go back to their province, I think it'll be a good change up for them. Although I think it's going to be tough. Leinster particularly, the drain on their squad and the injury toll and whatever else and the demands placed on their frontliners this season is going to make it difficult for them, perhaps. But I thought also maybe that Ireland played a little bit too much rugby in the first half in front of Scotland. By the simple expedient of being just much more direct at the start of the second half, they transformed the game, got the crowd into it. Bundy carrying over the line a couple of times. Robbie Henshaw carrying really hard. McCarthy carried hard a couple of times. Porter, another outstanding game from Porter. Like, he goes 70-odd minutes in every game last season's Grand Slam, every game this season's Six Nations, every game of the World Cup, every game in New Zealand. If anybody deserved a try, it was him. And by going much more direct and just carrying with much more intensity, I think, honestly, if that Tadhg Furlong try is given, Ireland probably win a little bit more comfortably than they did in the end. I think they had the momentum then, a try then beside the post, 17-6. I don't see any way back from Scotland from there.
Should it have been given?
I thought it should have been.
Yeah, it looked like it was in commentary as well. I think you get a rub of the, depending on which side you're on, you get a rub of the green. It all came down to what the question
completely
asked.
Basically, Carl Dixon who disallowed that try. He came in off the sideline. Matthew Carney hadn't decided, and he said, no try. He's the one that said no try. And then, who's the TMO? The South African guy?
Where's Jonker?
Your on-field decision is no try, didn't you say? As if they seem very reluctant to overrule on-field decisions now.
We can't. I think that's the... It does come down to what the question... Sorry, my understanding is that it comes down to what the question is. I think you're right. Matthew Carney came in and was very clear in his thing. I didn't see a grounding.
Dixon came in from the sideline and said that.
Yeah, I didn't see a grounding. So, like,
it's odd of Dixon to say that.
Yeah, like, but like, that's...
Why can't they just say, we're not sure for once in Blue Moon?
Yeah.
There's been a few wrong calls.
I sound a little bit maybe mental. I don't like to see a perfect system because you do want the referees to make on-field decisions. You don't want them to be getting so... You're taking away too much of their influence on games by putting everything up to a guy who's got a video camera, because we'll end in that thing. They're not going to be perfect, and sometimes anyway. I like to see them making and saying, "Okay, we're confident it's not an on-field try. What are you seeing?" It's one of those imperfections in that. I agree. I think it was a try when we were looking at it. There wasn't a separation, and it did get grounding. But it was, it wasn't perfect either. So
and it's an interesting one as well, because Peter O'Mahony went up and asked for them to all when he could kind of sense, because I think that's one of those, the longer it goes on, the more as an attacking team you probably get a feeling that this isn't going to go your way. The more they look at it, the more likely bad news is. So I think Peter O'Mahony saw that and kind of went up to Matthew Carley even and said, right, well, can you look at the tackle? Because he was asking for a head-on-head collision on Furlong as he went over the line. Again, he kind of just gets shrugged off a little bit.
He was very dismissive of both captains, wasn't he? I thought very dismissive.
But it happened. That happened last week as well, when in the build-up to the Ollie Lawrence try that wasn't, the knock-on, there was a lengthy TMO check. Jamie George also went up to the officials and checked a high tackle on Ellis Genge. It was seconds after Genge had actually entered that clear-out on Furlong. So, but it's almost as if, right, we're checking tries, but even though there are maybe head-on-heads or high tackles or other things in the build-up, we can't look at that at the same time. I don't know. It just seems like the system is a bit overwhelmed at the minute, there's too much going on.
So then what are you going to do? Put in like
another TMO.
The TMO's assistant going into it?
Certainly can't do that, no.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of commentary going on with referees at
Isn't
the moment.
There?
I wonder, have they been told, like, listen, you shut it down, don't get into it. Was it Neil Jenkins? That is brilliant.
Extraordinary.
Oh, it's worth going to find that clip online if you can find it. What is he literally just, he's carrying the water and he has the audacity to say to Matthew right now, you missed a high tackle, blue nine high tackle.
Picked the wrong ref there too.
Oh, there was a lot of, there was a finger point. There was finger in
the
chest.
Right. He was actually right now. Yeah. I wouldn't mess with Matthew Raynal, though.
What did he say? He said, well, I'm here to ref the match. And then Jenkins goes, well, ref the match then.
I'd suspect there will be a Razzie Erasmus style water carrier law change again after that. Because he told him not to come back onto the pitch, didn't he?
He said you can't come back on the pitch.
Bonkers. Absolutely bizarre. Before we kind of talk about big picture Ireland going forward, I do want to talk a little bit about Scotland, actually. I thought first half they were they defended really well. They kind of they shut down Ireland's attack, but in a very different way. Gregor Townsend was really good value afterwards. I thought in the press conference he gave a very clear kind of answer. He said there's two ways you stop Ireland. You either accept that you're going to go through the phases, sit off a little bit, but be really physical, as Andy Christie was, and be really disruptive at the breakdown and contact, or you do what England did, which is just you fly up and you try cut them off at source. They almost did what Wales did, Scotland, except they just had better players to do that and more physical players to do that. It was an interesting way of going about it.
Yeah. Which is, and again, talk about Scotland for me. So they did it really well. And what that actually looks like on the pitch is the player who's doing the tackle hops back up and belts into the ruck and tries to frustrate. And if you're looking back at the game, you see the amount of times Ireland will have a ball carrier plus two players in a scrum half. So they'll have four players at a ruck and Scotland will have nobody. And that just means they can keep the two in the
back, on their feet and yeah, against 11.
Keep two in the backfield and you can have 13 across the field and you've got to get up. And even with Ireland on a, you know, getting, I think they had about 55% of their rucks, 60% of their rucks were quick rucks. They're just running into, you're just running into players and they can condense the defensive line. They can have three players where had, you know, if Scotland don't have as many players on their feet, one or two in the rucks, in the space they would normally have only two, they're able to put an extra player, and it's very hard for Ireland to find space.
There's almost two issues with that kind of, you know, leave them at it and we'll back our fitness, we'll back our D type approach, because first of all, you got to do it for 80 minutes and you can fall off as they did in the second half. Wales fell off spectacularly when they did it. You know, you need to have, you know, five or six, probably six forwards on the bench who can contribute to that, which I don't think Scotland did. But then equally, you run the risk of not getting the ball. And in the second half, Jerry, that was Scotland's big issue. They just didn't get the ball.
Yeah, and, you know, they should have more regrets than they were expressing in the immediate aftermath of the game, I thought.
They were bizarrely
positive. Yeah, I mean, when you think of it, Ireland, they were good in defence in the first half. And I thought Ireland could have used maybe their maul more. They've got the most potent maul nearly in the tournament. Why not use a bit more? They did in the second half. And they really turned the screw with their scrum and their maul, didn't they, in the direct carrying. It was kind of what they've always done to Scotland. But they weren't doing that in the first half. And then Scotland just gifted them 7 points with that overthrow to a short line-out on their own line. And they hardly fired as an attack at all, the Scots, which is remarkable, really, when you think of what they are. And Finn Russell's restart out in the full was a big moment just after Jack Crowley's penalty. Knock-ons at untimely moments. And it was, I think we're all kind of relieved that Hugh Jones left until the 77, 78 minute for probably the best carry of the day to beat Robbie Henshaw like he did, and Caelan Doris and Josh Van Der Vleer before stepping James Lowe. It was probably the carry of the day, and thankfully there was only 2 minutes left, because you're all going, this was be unthinkable that Ireland, at least Ireland got the job done. At least they didn't, like, that would have been worse than that time they went for the Croke Park Triple Crown and Scotland beat them with Dan Parks' late penalty. This would have been altogether worse. So I think that the Scots were good defensively, but really didn't fire anything at all in attack. And if the truth be told, the score then flatters them a little bit, and they've got to look back at another campaign where, okay, it's a sweet one that they beat England four times in a row, but they've still ended up losing three of their five games, and they shouldn't be... They could have done so much better. They should have been coming to Dublin with the title on the line. It should have been a title shootout, and it was their own fault there wasn't. And you'd have to think if it was a title shootout, they might have fired a few more shots. I don't know.
Yeah. What it does is, it's, you know, go back to 2019, Six Nations. You're kind of at that tipping point now for Ireland where you're going, okay, have teams... Well, Gregor Townsend has come out and said, well, listen, here's two ways how you defend against Ireland. Which raises two kind of... So there is still space on the pitch. You have to then go and find it. So there are two people sitting in the backfield, so you got to have a better kicking game. We don't have a very good kicking game at the moment. And that was, for me, was kind of laid bare at the weekend. And then the other one is, you have to have players that can break tackles. And we don't have really anyone like that. You know, you look into who are the, you know, best teams in the professional era, say South Africa, Ireland, and England to a certain degree, they would have players that they can just give the ball to, that can either run over the top of somebody or say Cheslin Kobe, Will Jordan, that ilk, that kind of.
You make
of
a good point. It's why Scotland missed Sione Tupoluto as well, yeah, isn't it? Because he gives them that reference point in attack that Bundiaki gives Ireland. But the difference is Ireland have also got Robbie Henshaw and Stuart McCluskey. Now, I think your man did okay, Stafford McTowley, beat Bundiaki, but he was a real reference point for their attack. And they looked a bit blunt without him, didn't they, Tupoluto?
Yeah,
you need that, you're right. You
completely
need a big.
But like from Ireland, it's like who's our go-to when the game slows down? That can just
usually Bundy, isn't it?
Yeah, and he was, you know, but he's one player.
You need more.
Yeah. I think that's
a really, really good point because it brings us on to kind of where Ireland go. I think you're right. They played a lot of games this side, even though like it's not the oldest team in the world. They have brought in a couple of new, your younger faces, McCarthy, Crowley, etc. But they've played a hell of a lot of rugby together. As a group, I think sometimes you just do need that fresh edge.
Absolutely.
Twickenham laid bare what you're talking about, Darcy. You know, I think Aki and Lowe made quite a lot of ground themselves, but none of the forward carriers did. Sheehan was very quiet. Darcy was quiet. So, you know, do Ireland need a bit of freshening up there? Like, and where do those ball carriers come from? Because you're right, they don't have the power of other teams, but and equally, like you said, they don't have someone with Cheslin Colby's pace. They don't have someone with Will Jordan. You know, they do lack a little bit, which is it's interesting to look at. You look at the provinces, you go, well, where's that going to come from?
Yeah, I'd say we became a little bit predictable when Scotland were in position defensively before the Irish tack was. So they knew exactly where we were going before we knew where we were going. And that's, you know, they were clearly well drilled. They were had a very clear picture of what they were going to do. But most of the time, they knew pretty much where Ireland were going in attack. So we are looking for a system. We have that shape off Jack Crowley. We've got one forward on the front door, somebody out the back, and we the same shape then off the back, trying to go around teams. But teams are well drilled and well rehearsed to defend that shape now. So the challenge will be for Ireland that they need to evolve the attack shape that we're showing.
And the interesting thing about that is, and Andy Farrell said this afterwards, he knows the need to adapt. He knows he has to evolve. Andrew Goodman is going to South Africa. I don't think it's clear whether he's there as kind of a joint or an observing role with Mike Catt, who of course he is eventually replacing as attack coach. But he will be in South Africa, Jerry. So it's going to be very interesting to see what he comes up with. And that's a pretty big way of evolving your attack, is giving the keys to the car to someone else.
Yeah, and it's good that Goodman will be over there, as it were, to have such a close-up view of the Irish attack on tour. He's very good. He's very highly regarded in Leinster. They love working with him. His launch plays are very good. I actually thought Ireland's launch plays were very good on Saturday. Consistently brought in Nash or Lowe or Bundy up the middle or transferred to Robbie Henshaw and consistently got over the gain line, you know, really well. And then it was just, what, as Dar said, when it got into phases, there was that first half was just a blur of green running into a blue wall, isn't it? But the launch plays were actually good, but it's their phase attack that has been blunted a little bit now in the last couple of games. And Darcy is also right. No matter what system you have as well, you just need exceptional players at times as well, don't you? You just need a little bit of X factor. You think of the moment that really ignited Ireland last Saturday. It's probably James Lowe's carry at the start of the second half when he bumps their winger in Cainhorn and gets that extraordinary fend on the centre and gets an offload inside to Bundiaki. There are very few players, definitely, if there's any other player in Ireland that can do that. And that really ignited the crowd and the team.
What you want is you want to encourage more people to go off the team sheet. So you look at, say, Ben Earl last week. Two moments he just stops, pivots back and goes back on a little mazy run and ends up busting through like a couple of times through when he did it again against France at the weekend, where he just stuck his hand up and went, oh, I'm just going to go for a little wander here. And defences aren't programmed for that. And when you're really focused in defending a shape, you're almost programmed to go to a place because you know that. And when a player goes completely off script and, you know, ducks back under and starts heading back towards a ruck, Marcus Smith, excellent at that as well, they change the whole, you break that whole template of how teams are defending. So you want teams to be a little bit more, take a little bit more individual responsibility and just go.
Hansen does that too, doesn't he? And I'm not being critical. All of Calvin Nash, he's done really, really well. Got a couple of tries, try assist, and he's filled that role, that brief, really well. But Mac Hansen will go off script and do.
But he's not you're absolutely right. It's comparing apples and oranges because Mac Hansen is comfortable as a first receiver.
Yeah.
Calvin Nash is much more of a finisher and, you know, a traditional winger. But we just, you know, so if nobody, I think nobody filled that Mac Hansen role in this Six Nations, and majority of that fell to Jameson Gibson-Park, and he was fantastic in the probably the first three matches, but needed somebody else to be create that, you know, unpredictability with it. I think it wasn't there. So, you know, sometimes Ty Byrne probably not as he usually pops up and does something, and he was probably quiet the last two games as well. So I think that's just when we go into that phase shape. If somebody is not willing to do something a little bit different, that's when it can look a little bit too samey.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, because I don't think there are any other wingers in the provinces who do what Hansen does. I think it shows that if Hansen and Lowe, one or both are missing,
Ireland's depth chart wing is not great.
It's not great.
And
yeah,
in a few positions, completely. The depth chart is not great. Like, that's why Port is playing 70 minutes and fair play to Keane Healy, but like, the depth chart is not great in a few positions. And I don't remember Ireland's depth chart on the wings being so shallow as it is at the moment. Like, when you think of it, the two wingers basically are, one was a product of New Zealand, the other a product of Australia.
Exactly. Yeah, those kind of messy wingers were really good, skillful ball players. They didn't come up through the Irish system.
And you go back, like, geez, back in...
And we used to have so many, yeah.
The age of, back in my day, it was great. But every academy used to just be chock-a-block with wingers.
Mm. It was. You started on the wing, didn't you?
I did, yeah. But I was
full
actually,
back, really, weren't you?
Well, I started, yeah. I started at a full back, but then they realised I couldn't catch a high ball, so I got shifted out to the wing.
I remember once you danced through about 13 players in a schools game as well. I thought that was very good, Darcy. Yeah. The only reason, Jerry, is because I can't kick.
Exactly. But I don't know, I saw a clip on Gavin Henson, and he was playing on the wing. And Gavin Henson was no more... a winger.
Yeah.
But back in that era, you just basically, it was just a way of introducing players. You just put them always on the wing.
Well, what do you think? We've had Tommy Bowe, Shane Morgan, Dennis Hickey, Keith Earls, Andrew Trimble. And
like just
players.
Littered with them. Yes. But it's just they're just not coming through.
How many of those guys were your Mac Hansen going to stand at 10?
That's true. But like, this is a very different kind of system that Andy Farrell has in attack. And basically, you know, you would have thought in another era, Robert Balakoon might have won a good few caps for Ireland, but he doesn't suit the blueprint of the Irish attack. Basically, I can see probably made a little bit of the rugby league roots. He likes wingers who are ball players. They're former centres. They're converted centres. He likes a three-quarter line of three quarters, and they can intermingle and interchange positions and so forth. And be like, Lowe gives a really potent a reference point in the middle of the pitch through that strength and offloading game. And Hansen is a beautiful kind of square on, passing, checks, defence. They're ball playing wingers, and that's the way he wants them.
Exactly. And I think, I'm really glad you brought up Balakoon, because I think Ulster's kind of demise over the last 18 months has actually really harmed Ireland for a number of reasons. Well, first of all, Ulster don't play that style.
So they don't.
They don't ask Stockdale and Balakoon to do that.
Balakoon can be out in the wing for like 20 minutes and you won't see him in a game. And that's not going to do as Irish can.
20 minutes. You can be there for the whole 80 minutes.
You can't then call these guys up and say, right, you got to do what James Lowe does, because they just don't do it week in, week out. So it's really hard.
And now they're Brian Werner Cock as well.
And here's
which
the thing.
Makes no sense.
And even if you put someone in situ at Ulster who is going to use his wingers in a more Andy Farrell style, should be so, or maybe it's a Mike Catt thing. He's the attack coach after all. You know, like you said, they've just signed a South African wing who's going to play instead of Balakoon.
Makes
no sense.
Absolutely. But even if Balakoon's not there, there's plenty of young lads that's going there. That is like, that's a bizarre. Unless he's a back row in like a winger's clothing or something, they're going to use him in the back row or something. I don't know. That's one of the most bizarre signings I've ever seen.
The other interesting thing about Ulster, maybe kind of, you know, club versus country debate, so to speak, is you talk about Lucid. I mean, there were rumblings. I think the conversations have happened definitely at Irish level. There's rumblings about Tom O'Toole and what he's going to switch. But, you know, he signed a contract with Ulster as a tight head prop, a contract extension this year. So, I mean, for his career and his Ireland prospects, it absolutely makes sense for him to move across. You know, it looks like Ollie Yeager is kind of bumped ahead of him in the pecking order. Finlay Beelam's definitely ahead of him. Whereas Ireland don't have any loose heads, but who do Ulster have a very well-paid South African loose head in Stephen Kitsoff? So there's a bit of a conflict there. I can't really see that move happening.
Well, I was delighted for it was, in all of this, Finlay Beelam, because I'd say he had a, you know, finger around the collar moment when Ollie Yeager got onto the bench against Italy. It was like, oh, you know, is this happening? And he's come back and thought he was excellent when he came on again at the weekend and scrummaged and winning the penalty when he comes on was great.
continue my conversation with Gerry and Gordon after this short break. Welcome back to the Counter Ruck. My name is Nathan Johns. I'm still here with Gordon Darcy and Gerry Thornley as we discuss the end of the Six Nations Championship. Very nice touch from Peter O'Mahony. Let Tadhg Furlong lift the trophy.
Yeah,
he's had a difficult few months.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he played well, I thought, on Saturday.
He did play very well.
And he could have been given a try. And the scrummaging's been strong. Or Beelum's scrummaging was strong too. When you think the first scrum when Beelum came on, they absolutely blitzed the Scottish back. But yeah, that was a lovely moment from Peter. And ultimately, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Whether it's a book cover from a biography or whether it's just for a picture in your living room wall or on the mantelpiece, just lifting trophies. That's what it ultimately is all about. How many were you on, Darce? Three? Was it you in three Six Nations or two? Two or three? Three, wasn't it?
Three.
09, 14, 15.
Three. Yeah.
And like, I did a piece last Saturday on a catalogue of players who never won one. Like great players who played for the Lions, played for a decade for Ireland, played over 50, won over 50 caps. The likes of Keith Wood, Shane Horgan, Simon Easterby, Dennis Hickey. Loads of them never won one title. Here's Peter O'Mahony winning a fifth. And Keane Healy winning a fifth. Conor Murray winning a fifth and Ian Henderson winning a fifth. And I was astonished when I looked through the stats. I really poured through those five campaigns. And it's almost, Peter O'Mahony almost arrived, it was Rob Kearney. Rob Kearney started every one of the 20 games in the four titles in 09, 14, 15 and 18. Peter O'Mahony has started 22 of the 25 games. He's only missed three of those five title games, which is not what you'd expect. But you think of Peter O'Mahony being a bit broken and injured and not always fully fit, but he started all but three of those five championship campaigns, and all of them were against Italy. And one of them came off the bench. Like, he's been a remarkable contributor to Irish rugby.
He has, and I'm amazed it's actually taken us, half an hour roughly to actually remember that his future's up in the air. We don't know what's happening. He kind of gave a cryptic "we'll see" answer in the press conference when he was asked, is this his last game? I mean, and I'm really interested because you said this. You said that was a bit of an unfair question straight away.
Absolutely. Like, I was really disappointed. I mean, like, you've got him for, in the post-match, you've got him for 3 or 4 minutes. It doesn't have to be the first question out. It's like, that's not the biggest thing today. The biggest thing was Ireland won. I was annoyed for him. It's like, at least acknowledge the incredible achievement that's happened. So yeah, but then like inevitably it does come back around to, what does he want to do? I think as somebody who's been there in a very similar way, you very rarely get to sign off on your own terms. Like my last match was losing to Scotland in a warm-up match and not getting picked for the World Cup. So, you know.
Not everybody does a Dricko and signs off the Six Nations title. Good night, I'm out of here.
Balloons and big banners with his face on it.
Yeah, but it's always like 6 months, like at that age, very few people will do what Johnny did. And I think we have pace probably isn't, you know, at a premium, say, in back row. Like, it definitely was for me once my pace was gone. But like, it was terminal, you know, from 2004. You know, probably I wanted to go an extra 12 months and I blew up probably 9 months into that 12 months. And it was terminal. Yeah, but you can see they're going, like, I can't even, it impacts your ability to defend and your footwork and all these kind of things. You know, for Pete to go, like, what is he going to actually, what else is there to achieve in the next 15 months for him?
Yeah, he would look at it and say, do I want to go to South Africa and take on the world champions in their own backyard a year after World Cup? That might tempt him as one of final swan song, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the last time we see him in green in Ireland, if you know what I mean. I think that's a perfect way for him to sign off, lift the Six Nations trophy. I mean, and be a champion for a fifth time. He's also won a URC last year, finally, with Munster. After 10 years as a captain there, it looked like he might never win anything. So it's, I kind of think this might have, well, have been his last game.
Yeah, you got to think, like, the logical question. Yeah, he's going to have a chat with his missus and go.
That's what he said. Yeah.
But like, there's obviously going to be a chat with Graham Raintree and
Andy Farrell and David Humphries or David Nusafour. Maybe not. Maybe he'll just decide to.
Yeah. Well, like, Leo was the coach for Leinster, and he was just like, do you want me to stay on for the 3 months for cover for the World Cup? And he was like, no. Well, he was just like, you know, I don't need your experience. What I need to do is I need to give experience to these kids.
Yeah.
So he's there. You would just be blocking up my thing. So he was like, enjoy retirement.
And you get the sense that might be what has been happening with Munster in recent months. Obviously, you know, the contract offer was a bit slow to come, I think, and Tom O'Hearn was playing very well at six. So there's a little bit of that
going
on.
You don't want to be in a position to tarnish or anything. Sorry, that's actually probably a bit over dramatic. The end will be the end. Whatever it is, it might be great, it might be bad. It's the full stop. That will never define his career and his contribution to it. Moments like that will define his career and the classy thing of helping, letting Tadhg Furlong put it through. I think as a player, you will acknowledge at a certain point, and I'd say it'll be probably around now, you'll kind of look at it and go, okay, how much more can I get out of this game? And, am I deserving of a place? Right. And that's really important because as a player, if you're should be there. And I think that's the bit where you kind of, as much as he'll be chatting with Andy and his wife and, Graham Rowntree and everything, at a certain point you do sit down and go, yep, am I legitimately at this level still?
And he's taken a fair battering too, Gordon, hasn't he? Like, he's 34, high mileage, played a lot of games, over 100 games for Ireland.
Position he plays as well.
Yes, completely.
It's the nature of the beast.
Yes.
Speaking of back rows, Darcy, you picked in today's paper, you picked Ben Earl as your player of the tournament.
Yeah.
Discuss.
Yeah. Like, genuinely, I got eviscerated on Twitter for commentating about how much he celebrates when there's actually nothing to celebrate. So I'd say he was actually more, noteworthy for his celebrations than he was for anything he was really doing on the rugby field before the Six Nations. I think his rugby has been doing all the talking now. I think he's been really, really high quality, really impactful, big moments for England, multiple big moments for England, kind of like that Sean O'Brien type player, takes the game by the scruff of the neck.
A bit like Bundy, carried on from the World Cup. He was England's outstanding player in the World Cup too. Yeah,
very interesting player. Kind of came up as a poacher, kind of a poacher seven, one of those who didn't really carry very often. But he's moved to number eight and kind of revolutionises.
He could be a centre, couldn't he? Like he looks, reminds me a little bit of you and Draco. He's got that footwork.
Yeah, I don't think he's a number eight. He's just a really good back rower. You kind of find a space for him.
Like, electric footwork.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
brilliant.
Doesn't mean that Sean O'Brien type player, like dynamic, really powerful. Good over the ball as well.
Yeah,
he's really been. I thought he was really. He finished exceptionally strong.
What was the line about Sean O'Brien? He was the only Irish player that the Kiwis knew his name or something like that.
Yeah,
back
something
in the
like
day.
That. Yeah.
That might be now out having pints with him afterwards. So it might not be rugby related. So never know.
Well, he made a big splash in 2011 in the World Cup. The commentators kept referring to him as the Tullow Tank. He almost became like that back row.
And that's Lions tour as well. He was
yes,
2017. Yeah, he was phenomenal. Jerry, we'll finish up. Let's finish up more so on the tournament as a whole. I think before we started recording, I think we were all in agreement that the last two weekends really reignited the competition. Italy looked to be Gonzalo Quesada, the appointment was a masterstroke. He's doing well.
Arguably coached the tournament.
A lot of positivity around Wales from the opening few games seems to have disappeared after
so
what
end.
Happened. England, I think, are on the rise. I think
definitely
they're if they can get their attack and that South African style defence going with their kicking game, I think they'll be bloody hard to stop. France may or may not have turned a corner. Tricky to tell. We don't know what's going to happen there with Galtier, but it's a tournament that started on fire with that Ireland game and finished well.
Yeah.
If with a little bit of lull in the middle.
Yeah. It's amazing how much Ireland losing seems to have ignited the tournament. Everybody seemed very happy about that, which shows you what top dogs they'd become. I think it's been a really good tournament. Although it's finished similar to last season, ironically, Ireland first, France second, England and Scotland in the middle, just swapping places, and Italy and Wales in the bottom, swapping places. I think that kind of tells a lie a little bit because it was very fluid, very interchangeable, very competitive. 10 of the 15 matches were won by 4 points or less, including all three in the final weekend. Like, that's a good competitive tournament. And that's the essence of the Six Nations, that it is so competitive generally. And I think, Ireland retaining the title is brilliant. I think you're right about England. They're back with a vengeance the last two games, for sure. Be interesting to see how they go in the summer now in Japan and New Zealand. I think France probably have turned a corner in to some degree anyway, just with a little bit of an infusion of youth, like we started this very start of the show, how important that is, just get a few fresh faces in. They were tired and weary and had the biggest World Cup hangover at all. They almost pretty much removed it by the end. It was a cracking game against England and a great win for them to finish off with. And Wales are in deep trouble. They've got it's just a very shallow pool of players they've got. And I know they have a few injuries, but a very good generation is all retired together and they've left quite a void and the regions are not in good nick. But the boon of the tournament in some ways really was the Italians, wasn't it? Finishing with three unbeaten games in a row, they've never done that. And it could have been so easily three wins if Garbisi's conversion hadn't hit the upright and if the officials had done their job, that could have been three wins in a row. I think they would have finished second.
They would have finished second. If Garbisi's...
I think he's done a great job, Quezada, in that they've got a bit more balance to their game. They've got some cracking players. Juan Ignacio Brex, you know how much I like that player. I think he's had a really good tournament. Himself and Menoncello in the midfield. Probably rival the Irish midfield as the best midfield in the tournament. And, you know, Capuoto didn't even have him the last game. They won well against Wales. They've had a really good tournament. It's great to see. And the under-20s are going really well and some good wins. You'd worry a little bit for Scotland in the future. Their under-20s can't buy a win. You know, just can't buy one.
But I think a lot of it's a little bit like the with England and France a little bit. Any half-decent players in Scotland are shot up into the senior squad.
Yeah.
And you look at, say, the amount of players that bypass the 20s, really, in France and just go straight to the national team, maybe.
What I took away from the last weekend, Doris, was that Ireland are still in the top half of the table with France and England, which is what is really Ireland punching above their weight, because England and France should always be in the top half of the table. And if Ireland can just be consistently punching with France and England over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years into the future, you know, it'll be a hell of an achievement.
The Welsh thing is probably the biggest worry.
Yes,
for
yes, true.
Gatland offered his resignation. Did you see that?
Yeah, I'd say he had the fingers crossed going, take it. If that's the best players they have, you know, you can have the best coach in the world. You know, the quality, I don't think, is there of the players that have retired. And you look at George North now, the kind of last one that, who's kind of like, yep, see you later.
Sad off way to end, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Off to France.
Sad way to end, going off
England like that. It was, but like, you know, how many, like this is rebuilding. You know, we thought Joe Schmidt had a tough job in Australia. Warren Gatland is looking at this going, you know, where do the players come from? Mm. You know, particularly halfbacks, kind of going. Anyway, yeah, you hope it will turn a corner for them. But as a tournament again, like, yeah, it's just fantastic. It looked, you know, we had one narrative building over the first three matches, and then the script is torn up and off we go.
And that's the great thing about the Six Nations. It's never linear, is it? We forget that. Like, you know, it never just follows the same trajectory all the way through five rounds over 7 weeks. It's very intense, but it's open to so much fluctuation.
And it's amazing how quickly we forget that every year.
Every
time Ireland start winning some games, we forget that.
Yeah.
Right then, we will leave it there. My thanks as always to Gordon Darcy and Gerry Thorney. And lads, thank you for your efforts over this Six Nations campaign. This is the Counter-Ruck, sponsored by Nifty Business. Thank you for listening. Please do like, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts. We will see you next time.